hope, sir. Looks like one of their muleteers. He's in a bad way.
Good Lord. Someone didn't like him. How on earth did he get here?
Probably came from Basra, sir. Though how he managed it on foot with all them bullets in him is nothing short of a miracle.
He's still alive?
Just.
Right. Move him in the shed, give him some water. Nothing more we can do.
Something is coming.
Great Scott! He's English. All right, old fella. You're safe now. Corporal.
Sir.
Fetch the medic, quickly.
Sir.
Captain, this message. Urgent.
All right, old fella. I've got it all. I'll see it gets to General Delamain. Never fear.
Something is coming from the west. Kasreddin.
Greenmantle by John Buchan. Dramatized by Patricia Hannah. Part 1. November 1915.
The sight of the name Bullivant on a telegram form carried me back 18 months to that business with German spies before the war. I hadn't seen the man since, though I had read about him in the newspapers.
Everything all right, Dick?
For more than a year, I had been a busy battalion officer. And there was no prouder man on earth than Richard Hannay when he took his Lennox Highlanders over the parapets on that glorious and bloody 25th day of September. Loose was no picnic, but it was a tea party to the show I had been in with Bullivant, when I had hunted and been hunted by agents of the Black Stone.
Well, bad news, I hope.
Hmm? What's that, Hannay?
The telegram. Not bad news.
It's from Sir Walter Bullivant. He wants to see me.
Hello? Well, that means you've got the battalion. Mm. Congratulations, old fellow.
No, Sir Walter's foreign office. Nothing to do with straightforward fighting. Not a word from him since that 39 steps business. Now this telegram. What on earth can the foreign office want with an obscure major in the Lennox Highlanders?
Well, I probably heard what a good show you put on at Loose and want to give you a staff job. Oh, good Lord, Dick. You'll be a blighted brass hat stuck in an office in Whitehall.
Now I have to report to him in London in double quick time.
Corporal!
Damn. Just when things were starting to get interesting here.
If you come back, bring some marmalade from Faulkner's. That's a good fella.
London in November. Is there anything more depressing? I envy you men at the front, Major Hannay, escaping the English weather.
I would not have recognized Sir Walter. His big frame seemed to have shrunk. His hair was much greyer, and there were lines of overwork below the eyes. But the eyes were the same as before, keen and deadly and shrewd, and there was no change in the firm set of the jaw.
Well, Major Hannay, how do you like soldiering?
Right enough, though this isn't just the kind of war I would have picked myself. It's a comfortless, bloody business. But we've got the measure of the old Boche now, and it's dogged as does it.
How's the leg? Doctors get all the shrapnel out?
Oh, yes. I'm as tough as a shambok. I was back at the front within the month. I thrive on the racket and eat and sleep like a schoolboy. But I wish to heaven it was over.
No one could question your courage. What exercises my mind is whether it's best employed in the trenches.
What? Is the War Office dissatisfied with me?
Oh, on the contrary. They propose to give you command of your battalion. Presently, if you escape a stray bullet, you will no doubt be a brigadier. Ah, it's a wonderful war for youth and brains. Now, Hannah, how if you could help your country better than by commanding a battalion? How if there is a thing you alone can do? You're fond of tackling difficulties. Well, I can give you a task which will try all your powers.
I'm a soldier, and under orders.
True. But what I'm about to propose does not come by any conceivable stretch within the scope of a soldier's duties. I shall perfectly understand if you decline. You'll be acting as any sane man would.
Let me hear what your proposition is.
Have you by any chance been following the present campaign in Turkey?
Yeah, I've got some pals in the Mesopotamia show, and of course I'm keen to know what's going to happen at Gallipoli and Salonika.
I won't go into all the reasons why Turkey's left the rail. Suffice it to say, she has her grievances. You're an intelligent fellow, Hannay, and you will ask how Enver Bey and his precious committee should have got control of a proud race.
Well,
you'll inquire again how, since Turkey is primarily a religious power, Islam has played so small a part in it all. The ordinary man will answer that Islam in Turkey is becoming a back number, and that Krupp guns are the new gods. I do not quite believe that. Germany and Enver Bey alone could not drag Turkey into a European war.
Yes.
No, there's a dry wind blowing through the east, and the parched grasses wait the spark. Whence comes that wind, think you? Have you an explanation, Annie?
It looks as if Islam has a bigger hand in the thing than we thought. I fancy religion is the only way to knit up such a scattered empire.
Exactly. We have laughed at the holy war, but I believe there is a jihad preparing. The question is, how?
I'm hanged if I know. But I'll bet it won't be done by a pack of stout German officers in pickle harbours.
Agreed. But supposing that they've got hold of some tremendous sacred sanction, some holy thing, or some new prophet from the desert, something which will madden the remotest Muslim peasant with dreams of paradise. What then, my friend?
Then there will be hell let loose in these parts pretty soon.
Hell which may spread beyond Persia lies India.
How much do you know?
Oh, very little, except the fact, but the fact is beyond dispute. I have reports from agents everywhere. They tell the same story. The East is waiting for a revelation. It has been promised. Some star is coming out of the West. The Germans know, and that is the card with which they're going to astonish the world.
And the task you spoke of for me is to go and find out?
Yes. That is the crazy and impossible mission.
But I never saw a Turk in my life. But except a chap who did wrestling turns in a show at Kimberley. You've picked about the most useless man on earth.
You've been a mining engineer, Hannay. You have a nose for finding gold, yes. And I believe that you have a nose for finding out what our enemies try to hide. I know that you are brave and cool and resourceful. That is why I tell you the story.
And where should I begin prospecting?
I'm afraid I can't tell you where you'll get on the track of the secret. It's known in Germany to those whom it concerns. It's moving eastwards, but it's in Europe that the seeker must search at present.
Obviously, you can give me no help if I come to grief.
You would be beyond the pale.
You give me a free hand?
Absolutely. You can follow whatever plan you fancy and go anywhere you think fruitful. We can give no directions.
One last question. You say it's important, Sir Walter. Tell me how important.
It is life and death. If the East blazes up, our efforts will be distracted from Europe. The stakes are no less than victory or defeat.
If you think me competent enough for a sporting chance,
I'll go. Give me a hand, Hannay. I may be sending you to your death. Good God. What a damn taskmistress duty is.
Sir Walter had an appointment at Downing Street. He gave instructions to his driver to drop him there, then take me to my rooms in Park Lane. We talked as the car drove through a regular London November drizzle.
The streets look like a battlefield nowadays. All those uniforms and badges. I've no idea what half of them are.
There's an officer in my battalion I'd like to have as a companion on this mission, Sir Walter. His name is Sandy Arbuthnot.
Billy Arbuthnot's boy? His father was at Harrow with me. I know the fellow. Tallish, with a lean, high-boned face and a pair of brown eyes like a pretty girl.
Yes, that's Sandy.
Yeah, we know a great deal about him in the Foreign Office. He used to take a hand in Turkish politics and got a huge reputation.
I knew Sandy had knocked about the East, but I didn't know he was that kind of swell.
You say he's in your battalion. Yes, I was wondering what had become of him. Well, The Honourable Ludovic Augustus Arbuthnot, buried deep in the ranks of the army. We'll get him out pretty quick.
I'll send him a wire this afternoon.
Now, Major Hannay, I've got another colleague for you, if you like. His name is Mr. John Scantlebury Blenkiron, born and raised in Indiana.
An American?
Blenkiron's the best man we ever had. He would go through hell with a box of bismuth tablets and a pack of patience cards. Now tell him I think you two should meet. Ask him to dine at your club.
What am I to say to him? And Sandy?
Now, this piece of paper is the only clue we possess. Now, take it.
Three words.
Kazradin, cancer, and VI.
What do they mean?
I cannot construe it, but I can tell you the story. We've had our agents working in Persia and Mesopotamia for years, mostly young officers of the Indian Army. They carry their lives in their hand, and now and then one of them disappears, and the sewers of Baghdad might tell a tale. 3 months ago, one staggered into General Delamain's camp with 10 bullet holes in it. He mumbled his name and gave them that paper. Since he cried out the word Kazradin in his last moments, it must have had something to do with his quest. It's for you to find out if it has any meaning.
I'll do my best, Sir Walter.
Ah, here we are. Call for me at 4 p.m., driver. Goodbye, Major Hannay. And good luck.
Thank you. Sir Walter, That fellow who died, who was he?
His name was Harry Bullivant. He was my son. God rest his brave soul.
Blenkiron was a big fellow with a sallow, clean-shaven face and a pair of full, sleepy eyes. He was not too plump, and very muscular wrists showed below his shirt cuffs. I fancied that, if the occasion called, he might be a good man with his hands. I hope the fish is cooked as you instructed, Mr. Blenkiron.
Boiled to perfection, Major Hannay.
I'm sure you won't try a little of this claret.
No, thank you, Major Hannay.
Potatoes, Mr. Blenkiron?
No, thank you, Captain Arbuthnot. I regret that I cannot join you and Major Hannay in sampling that fine pie. Beef steak and oyster, you say? I suffer from dyspepsia. Duodenal dyspepsia. It gets me 2 hours after a meal and gives me hell just below the breastbone. So I am obliged to adopt a diet. My nourishment is plain boiled fish, gentlemen. And milk and a little dry toast.
Well, that's jolly hard luck, sir.
The good God has not given John S. Blenkiron the kind of martial figure that would do credit to the tented field. And I regret that I've never seen the lawless passions of men let loose on a battlefield.
What have you been doing, sir?
Well, Captain, the Lord has blessed me with money to burn, so I didn't need to go scrambling like a wildcat for war contracts. But as we Americans are neutrals, I was in an advantageous position to take a hand. I reckon I would leave God's country and see what was doing in Europe. I reckon that a neutral can have a share in the scrap as well as a belligerent.
Have you spoken to Sir Walter?
I have spoken to him, and he has given me to understand there's a deal ahead which you are going to boss. They are no flies on that big man. If he says it's good business, then you can count me in.
What about you, Sandy?
Well, for heaven's sake, Dick, tell me what it is.
It's about as safe and easy as going through the German lines with a walking stick.
Come, that's not so dusty. Shall I finish the last of the pie? Bit of a shame to waste you.
Sandy, Mr. Blenkiron, is the wandering Scot carried to the pitch of genius.
Oh!
If fate compelled you to go to Lhasa or Yarkand or Seistan, he could map out your road for you and pass the word to potent friends. In the old days, he would have led a crusade or discovered a new road to the Indies. Now he merely roams as the spirit moves him.
Dick, old man, dreamt of pies like that in the trenches. Can I tempt you to another glass of milk, Mr. Blenkiron?
On the whole, I'd rather hear what Major Hannay has to tell us.
Yes, Dick, what's the story?
We'll have coffee in the library. No one will disturb us there. Over coffee and cigars, I told them about the puzzle in the Near East. I pitched a pretty good yarn, for the mystery of the business had caught my fancy. Blencarran took a pack of patience cards from his pocket and began to play the game called Double Napoleon. Sandy's face had grown solemn.
The whole thing's possible enough. Indeed, I've been expecting it, though I'm hanged if I can imagine what the Germans have got up their sleeve. It might be one of 20 things. You never know what'll start of a jihad, but I rather think it's a man. He would have to be something extra special to put a spell on the whole Muslim world.
Do you think that's possible?
Perfectly. He must be of the blood of the Quraysh, the tribe of the Prophet himself. Then he'd have to be a rather a wonder on his own account. Saintly, eloquent, that sort of thing. And I expect he'd have to show a sign, though what that could be, I haven't a notion.
Well, that's the ground clear to begin with.
But we have no clues, except these three words on the piece of paper. They mean nothing to me, but they must be intelligible to somebody, or Harry Bullivant wouldn't have written them down.
I saw his name in the casualty lists. Fire away, Dick. Harry didn't do things without a purpose.
Well, the first word is Kazradin.
Kazradin? Kazradin is nothing. It means in Arabic, the house of faith, and might cover anything from Hagia Sophia to a suburban villa. What's next?
Cancer.
Latin for a crab. Painful disease and a sign of the zodiac.
And the last one isn't a word, it's the letters.
V and I.
Let's see. V, I. Well, beats me, Dick, but it may be the clue for all that. The clue may be dumb in London and shout aloud in Baghdad.
Sir Walter says this thing is important for our cause. He offers me the job of going out to find what the mischief is. Once he knows that, he can soon checkmate it. But it's got to be found out soon. Will you help me? If we fail, nobody can help us.
Oh, of course. Naturally.
The whole thing is stark lunacy.
It's idiocy. But all war is idiocy. And the most wholehearted idiot is apt to win. I'm with you, old fellow. But I don't mind admitting that I'm in a blue funk.
Then I take it you're coming.
Rather. You don't imagine I'd want to miss it.
And you, Mr. Blencarran?
Why, yes. You gentlemen mustn't think that I haven't been following your most engrossing conversation. I haven't missed a syllable. I find that a game of patience stimulates the digestion after meals and conduces to quiet reflection. John S. Blencarran is with you all the time.
Well, that's settled. Now for ways and means. We three have got to go where Germany's secret is known. Somehow or other, we have to reach Constantinople. And to beat the biggest area of country, we must go by different roads. Sandy, you've got to get into Turkey. You're the only one of us that knows that engaging people.
Leave that to me.
You, Mr. Blencarran, are an American and can travel through Germany direct. Problem is, you're known as a supporter of the Allied cause.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have considered that, sir. I shall visit the fatherland as John S. Blencarran. Once a thorn in the flesh of their brightest boys in the States. But it will be a different John S., I reckon he will have come to appreciate the great, pure, noble soul of Germany and will be sorrowing for his past like a converted gunslinger at a revivalist meeting.
Will that be enough?
I will confide to them valuable secret information about British preparations. And then I shall move eastwards to see the demolition of the British Empire in those parts.
You haven't told us your own line, Dick.
Oh, I'm going to the Bosphorus through Germany.
Is your German good enough?
Pretty fair. Quite good enough to pass as a native. But officially, I shall not understand one word. I shall be a Boer from Western Cape Colony. I shall talk Dutch and nothing else, and my hat, I shall be pretty bitter about the British. With luck, they may send me to Uganda or to Egypt, and I shall take care to go by Constantinople. They want me to deal with Mohammedan natives. They're bound to show me what hand they hold.
Where is the rendezvous to be?
Well, this is the 17th day of November. If we can't find out what we want in 2 months, we may chuck the job. So on the 17th of January, we should foregather in Constantinople. Sandy, you know the city. You fix the meeting place.
Yes, I thought of that. There's a lane runs down from the Kurdish bazaar in Galata to the ferry in Racek. Halfway down on the left-hand side is a cafe kept by a Greek called Kaprasso. Behind the cafe is a walled garden, at the end of which is a shanty called the Garden House of Suleiman the Red. The ends of the earth converge there, and no questions are asked. That's the best spot I can think of for our meeting place.
Well, gentlemen, here's to our next meeting. At the Garden House of Suleiman the Red.
Suleiman the Red.
I sailed on December the 3rd from Liverpool on a ship bound for Lisbon. My passport said my name was Cornelis Brandt, and passports never lie. Lisbon would be a good jumping-off place. It was the rendezvous of scallywags from most parts of Africa. I took a room at the station hotel and set out to look for a likely place to begin my new life as a fire-eating young boor itching to get a shot at England. The place I chose to introduce Cornelis Brandt to Lisbon was a big, well-lighted cafe on a main street. There were a lot of sharp-eyed fellows wandering about that I guessed were spies and police agents. I looked around for an empty table, and that was when I saw Peter Pienaar. And he saw me.
I don't believe it! Over here!
Peter! What are you doing here? You old desperado!
Cornelis Brandt is my name now, and don't forget it.
Yeah, yeah. Cornelis. It's good to see you.
Peter Pienaar was the man that taught me all I ever knew of Feltcraft. When the Boer War started, Peter took the British side and did most of our intelligence work in the northern Transvaal. His people would have hanged him if they could have caught him. At the time when I left Africa 2 years before, I heard that he was somewhere on the Congo poaching elephants. It looked as if he had been living hard lately. He was 56 years old and used to be taken for 40. Now, he looked his age.
Try some of this, Cornelis. It's called Curaçao.
So, what have you been up to, Peter?
When the war began, I was in German territory. The skellum of an officer came along and commandeered all my mules. He wanted to commandeer me for his fool army. So, I shot him.
Good Lord.
It was all right. He fired first on me. That was the beginning of bad trouble. By and by, I thought I'd better clear out for Europe. So here I am, Cornelis, my old friend. If I shave my beard, will they let me join the Flying Corps?
No, you're coming with me, my lad. We're going into Germany.
Yeah, keep in mind that I don't like Germans. I'm a quiet Christian man, rather devil of a temper.
I told Peter the story of our mission, and we spent the evening piling up evidence in our favor. Curaçao was a new drink to him, and presently his tongue ran freely. He was shouting that the time was coming when the Englander would sing small, when a little scrap of a man in a fur coat approached our table with a waiter in tow.
There's a gentleman drink a glass of beer with me?
Who the devil are you?
Gott, Strafe, England!
Amen, my friend. We don't mind if we do.
Waiter, beer for my friends. It is good beer from München. Prost. You are from South Africa. What do you do in Europe?
That's our business.
So. Then I will put it differently. From your speech just now, I judge you do not love the English.
My dear grandmother's rotten ale. Prost.
So, you are on the German side.
That remains to be seen. If they treat us fair, we'll fight for anybody that makes war in England. England has stolen our country, corrupted our people, and made us exiles. We Afrikaners do not forget. Prost. We two men can be valuable to Germany. She's fighting England in East Africa. We know the natives.
Cornelis and I can handle the blacks, so they will fight like devils for fear of us.
We ask no reward for our services, little man. We fight for hatred of England.
Sehr gut. There is room in Germany for men such as you. Listen, a ship leaves tomorrow for Rotterdam. If you take my advice, you will go with her. From there, you can travel by train to Berlin. I will arrange your journey and the papers to enter Germany. It is my business to help the allies of my fatherland.
The little chap turned up at our hotel next morning after breakfast, bringing the steamer tickets. On my advice, he did not see us off. But Peter took £20 off him for travelling expenses.
I am glad we are going among the Germans, Cornelis. They are a generous people whom it is a pleasure to meet.
The Germans were generous. No fewer than 6 sentries escorted us from the train when it reached the German border. Peter and I were an odd pair of scallywags to look at. Both of us wore ready-made tweed suits and felt hats with broader brims than they like in Europe. Peter had a scarlet satin tie you could hear a mile off. We fairly reeked of the subcontinent. On our arrival in Berlin, we were taken to a big building to meet some government official.
The Undersecretary will see you now, gentlemen.
Three p.m. exactly. Punctuality is one of our German virtues.
Herr Brandt and Herr Pienaar, Excellency.
Thank you, Lieutenant. Wait outside.
The Undersecretary was a little man in spectacles, with his hair brushed back from his brow like a popular violinist. He had a paper before him and began to ask us questions from it. His Dutch was slow and careful, but good.
I understand neither of you speak German.
No.
No, boss.
There was another man in the room. He stood with his back to the fire, leaning his elbows on the mantelpiece. He was a perfect mountain of a chap, 6.5 feet if he was an inch, with shoulders on him like a shorthorn bull.
You both fought the English under General Merritt, Herr Pienaar.
Yeah, that's right.
The fellow was in uniform, and the black and white ribbon of the Iron Cross showed at a buttonhole. His tunic was all wrinkled and strained, as if it could scarcely contain his huge chest.
Where did you fight?
Kakamas, in Schutdrift.
He had a great, lazy, smiling face, with a square, cleft chin which stuck out beyond the rest. His brow retreated, and the stubbly back of his head ran forward to meet it, while his neck below bulged out over his collar.
Before the war, what was your occupation, Herr Pienaar?
Yeah, that's my name.
And your occupation?
Peter?
No, no. What did you do before the war?
I'll talk to their excellency. You are too academic for these outland schwine.
Here was the German of caricature. The real German. The fellows we were up against. He was as hideous as a hippopotamus, but effective. Every bristle on his odd head was effective.
You have heard of me. I am the Colonel von Stumm who fought the Herals.
Yeah, boss. You cut off the chief Bavian's head and sent it in pickle about the country.
I see I am not forgotten. So I treat my enemies, and so will Germany treat hers. You too, if you fail me by a fraction of an inch. You Boers had the chance to drive the English into the sea, and you flung it away. Dummkopf!
Colonel von Stumm, please! The carpet is government property.
My apologies, Excellency, but that is what I think of Sir General Maritz and also Dutch. You, Inna, what do you come here for? What can you offer us Germans? South Africa is counted out in this war. Can you deny that?
No, boss. That is true.
Then what in God's name can you do? You see, Excellency, a pair of dumb dogs.
Let me speak.
Ah, the other dog can bark.
My friend is a great hunter, but he fights better than he talks. He is no politician. What you say is true. South Africa is a closed door for the present, and the key to it is elsewhere. Here in Europe, and in the East, and in other parts of Africa. We have come to help you find that key.
Go on, my little boy. It will be a new thing to hear Taka on world politics.
You're fighting the English in East Africa. And soon you may fight in Egypt. You want to beat the English here in Europe. Therefore, you try to divide them and have them scattered throughout the globe while you stick at home. That is your plan?
You have a brain, Brandt. Of sorts.
England fears for Egypt. And she fears, too, for India. She will not let East Africa go. If you press her there, she will send armies and more armies till she is so weak in Europe that a child can crush her. So I say, press there. And press hard.
How is the devil are we to press? The accursed English holds the sea. We cannot ship men or guns there.
You need men. And the men are waiting. All round your borders, you have the remains of the great fighting tribes. The Maasai, the Manyumwezi, and above all, the Somalis of the north and the dwellers on the Upper Nile.
We already recruit our black regiment, sir.
Now, that is not enough. You must set whole nations moving. As the Zulu under Shaka flowed over South Africa.
It cannot be done, Herr Brandt.
It can be done, Excellency. We too are here to do it. We Afrikaners see into the black man's heart. And though he may hate us, he does our bidding. We must get his gods on our side, and then he will move mountains.
That's all foolishness.
It is sober common sense. You must find the race that fears its priests. It is waiting for you. The Muslims of Somaliland and the Abyssinian border and the Blue and White Nile. They would catch fire like dried grass if you used the flint and steel of their religion. That is the way of Africa. Thousands in Nimadi's army had never heard of the prophet till they saw the black flags of the emirs going into battle.
Excellency, this is the man for Hilda.
Shh. With a care, Colonel.
Well, Brandt, you are a dreamer. But who is going to kindle the flame?
You.
What the devil do you mean?
That is your part. You already have half the Muslim lands in your power. It is for you to show us how to kindle a holy war, for clearly you have the secret of it.
We have no secret.
What secret could we have?
I do not believe you. You're playing games with me. I've not come 6,000 miles to be made a fool of.
Discipline, by God! This army is none of your haggard commanders!
Oh, goodness!
Shut your mouth or you will get the same. Now get out, both of you. And remember that I am your master. I, Ulrich von Stumm, who owns you as a kaffir owns his monkey. Germany may have some use for you, my friend, when you fear me as you never feared your God.
As I walked dizzily away, the big man was smiling in his horrible fashion, and the little undersecretary was grinning too. It was the first time I had been bullied without hitting back, but I thanked heaven I had shown no temper or that I understood German, for I remembered my mission. Luck seemed to have brought me into useful company. The next day, Peter and I separated. He was left behind in Berlin, and I was taken to the station. I was pleased when I heard I was going somewhere with Stumm. If he wanted to see me again, he must think me of some use. And if he was going to use me, he was bound to let me into his game. The train sped southward, mostly through hills and woods. In the carriage with us was a thin, middle-aged man with the stoop in the shoulder that one gets from being constantly on horseback.
Brandt, this is Herr Gaudian. He's the greatest engineer in the world. He built the Baghdad and Syrian railways.
Is this the Dutchman, Herr Colonel?
Cornelis Brandt, yes. I've told you of his plan.
Too late. It should have been done at the beginning. We neglected Africa, you know the reason why.
The von Einem, perhaps. But her charm isn't working well enough.
We had better talk of this another time, Herr Colonel.
Ignore the poor. He does not understand German.
You understand my Dutch, Herr Brandt?
Yeah.
Good. Now, tell me, how would you make trouble for the British?
Up in the north, among the Muslim peoples. But there you must help me. I know nothing about Islam. I gather you do.
Why?
Because of what you have done already.
In Mantle.
Hashkana. That name should not be spoken outside the inner circle.
I wondered if I'd got a clue. Stumm had talked of a von Einem woman, perhaps the same woman as the Hilde he had mentioned to the Undersecretary. I wish I could have caught the word Stumm had whispered to Gaudian, but I'd only heard something that sounded like Unmantel, which wasn't any German word I knew. The winter evening closed in. I saw we had come out of the hills and were in a flat country. The train began to slow down.
Listen to me, Brandt. Herr Gaudian and I are inclined to make use of you. If you are a rogue, you will have little scope for roguery. If you succeed, we will not forget it. Now, you will come with me to my home and get your orders.
Schwandorf! Schwandorf!
Farewell, Gaudian! Right. Carry the bags.
Goodbye, Herr Gaudian.
I hope we will meet again, Herr Brandt, when God has given us victory.
Schwandorf was a small town surrounded by dark woods, where the snow lay deeper than in the north. We didn't have far to go. On a hill above the town stood a big black castle, the home of von Stumm. Inside, the place was very noble and very ancient. I had the uncomfortable feeling of being in a prison. The sight of Stumm's study took my breath away. It was so unexpected. Here was a place all luxury and color and light. This was the room of a man who had a fashion for frippery, a perverted taste for soft, delicate things. I began to see the queer other side to my host, that evil side which gossip had spoken of as not unknown in the German army. The room seemed a horribly unwholesome place, and I was more than ever afraid of Stumm. I was relieved when an elderly servant came to show me to my own rooms. There I found, in front of a cheerful fire, a hip bath, already filled with hot water, and soft, clean towels. It was my first bath since I had left Lisbon.
We will now settle your business, Herr Brandt. You will go to Egypt. This card will be your passport. Keep it safe. It is your badge as an accredited agent of the German crown.
Where do I go after Egypt?
That remains to be seen.
How do I get there?
You will travel by Holland and London.
London?
You have no cause to be afraid. I guarantee you will be asked no questions by the British. Your passports are in order and will be given to you at the frontier. We manage these things well in Germany.
Here was a pretty kettle of fish. I was already well on my way to the east. The Danube could not be many miles off, and that way ran the road to Constantinople. But I knew that they would not let me out of their sight till they saw me in Holland. I was like a rat in a trap.
Does your heart fail you, my little boor? You are afraid of the English? I will tell you one thing for your comfort. There's nothing in the world to be feared except me. Fail me, and you will find the world a cold place. Colder even than this!
Damn! That water's cold as ice!
It is good Bavarian water! Fresh from the mountains. The drowned rat would like to bite. But the rat has found its master. Smile! Or I will make pulp of you.
You infernal cat. I'm going to knock the stuffing out of you. Take that!
Oh, no, God in Himmel! I will kill you all!
Yes, well, you need to be quicker than that, Stum.
You stand still, you vermin.
Coward! Boots and brute force against a naked man.
I will crush you to a pulp.
Still too slow. You don't like it, do you? Somebody standing up to you. You're a bully. Kick me, would you? Now, I'm angry. Black Monty at Kimberley. Caught me to fight. But he taught me to fight clean. Take that!
Stum lay spread-eagled in the bath. He didn't get up. I dressed quickly and put on my ulster. I picked up the pass from where it had fallen on the floor and ran downstairs. My luck held. I found the front door unlocked. I opened it and walked out into the night. Now I would be hunted like an animal. I had put Stum to sleep for a bit, but I couldn't flatter myself that he would long be quiet. And when he came to, he would come looking for me. As soon as I was out of sight of the castle, I turned off the road and into the forest. I spent a cold night in the woods, trying to shelter from the wind and snow in a hole underneath the roots of an oak tree. This morning, I had risked going into the village to buy some food. I knew the desperate business I was in for. I was alone in the heart of South Germany. I had a fever, and Stum was behind me, looking for my blood. I would have to go on and on till I dropped. What I wanted was a nice cup of tea.
Grüß Gott.
Grüß Gott. Who are you?
I'm a mother. I've been gathering holly to decorate the cottage for the children.
Grüß Gott, Mutter.
Can I help you?
I am lost. Yesterday, I got caught up in a snowstorm.
It was very bad.
And now, I have a fever.
Oh dear.
It will pass in a day or two. If you could give me shelter.
You are welcome, mein Herr. Our cottage is nearby.
Thank you. You're most kind.
There's no weather for a sick man. I don't expect to meet anyone. Most people are at home on Christmas Eve.
I'm a member of the Imperial Secret Service. Here's my warrant.
Yes.
If you will permit it, I will stay till I am better, but no one must know I am here. If anyone comes, you must say nothing about me.
Yes. Yes. You can have the bed in the garret and be left in peace till you're well. We have no neighbours near, and the storm will have closed the roads. I will be silent, I and the children.
There's food in my rucksack. Oh. Biscuits, ham and chocolate. Please, please, take it. And here is some money to buy Christmas gifts for your children.
God bless you. The good Lord has sent you. And the children will have their prayers answered and the Christ child will not pass our door tonight. Come. This way.
Thank you.
It was a bad bout of fever. I lay 4 days like a log in that garret bed. On the fifth day, Wednesday the 29th of December, the fever left me and I was well enough to get up. I dressed, went downstairs and sat on the bench by the front door of the cottage. There, in the winter sunshine, watching the children play among the trees, I saw the crazy folly of war. What good would it do Christian folk to burn poor little huts like this and leave children's bodies by the wayside? To be able to laugh and to be merciful are the only things that make men better than the beasts.
Not so much noise, children. Remember, our guest has been ill.
To that woman, the struggle meant nothing. It was an act of God that had taken her husband away to fight, and might soon leave her a widow and the children fatherless.
You're looking much better today.
Thank you. I feel better.
What are you reading? A letter from your wife? Your mother?
No, it's only a puzzle. To pass the time.
Ooh, you let me see. I like puzzles. There. Cas rad in, cans er, the one.
No, not one. I.
Oh, I thought it was a number. Oh, so it's too difficult for me. I shall make you another herbal infusion. It's good for you.
Thank you. Of the two letters, I had thought the V must stand for von, and had always taken the I as the letter of the alphabet. Now this simple woman had shown it might be the number one, Einem in German. I almost fell off the bench. Von Einem. The name I had heard Stumm mention, the name to which Hilda was probably the prefix. It was the first real bit of light I had found. And that word Stumm had whispered to Gaudian, Unmantel. If only I could get that clear, I would solve the riddle. The discovery filled me with strength and hope. I left that day. The woman told me that the Danube was only an hour's walk away. The track ran through the wood straight to the ferry. I gave my hostess and the children 2 gold sovereigns apiece. I kissed the little ones, shook the woman's hand, and went off down the road. They cried, "Auf Wiedersehen!" But it wasn't likely I would ever see them again. I stood in the rain beside the Danube. It was Thursday, the 30th of December. I was due in Constantinople on the 17th of January. It seemed as distant as the moon, but the big sullen river in front of me led to it. As I looked, I saw a river steamer with a line of barges in tow moving toward the shore. It moored opposite me, and I could see a man in uniform whom I took to be the captain. I waved at him and hallooed.
Captain! Where are you going?
To Rostov. Then the cargo goes on to Constantinople by rail.
Do you need an extra hand?
Not unless heaven has sent me an engineer.
Well, I am no angel, but I am an engineer.
Then, God be thanked. I send the boat over for you. You don't drink, do you?
No.
What? Walter drank. That's why I need a new engineer.
I thanked Walter from the bottom of my heart and wished him a long and happy life, wherever he was.
You there. I'm Herr Brandt, the new engineer. Take care to do your work well, and you'll find me a reasonable master.
Cornelis?
Peter? By all that's holy!
It's good to see you, Cornelis. I thought you'd be traveling in first-class carriages.
The gods must be on our side, Peter.
First I turn up just when the captain is in need of an engineer.
The old one got drunk and broke his leg.
Then I find Peter Pienaar working as a stoker. How in the name of all that's holy did you get here?
It was very simple, Cornelis. I was unhappy in Berlin when you'd left. I did and said some foolish things in a cafe. I told you I didn't like Germans. I knew they'd put me in prison, so I started walking southeast in the direction of Constantinople. Then I found this big river.
You're an old Trojan, Peter.
I met Captain Schenk in an inn and told him I was a poor Dutchman traveling on foot to see my dying mother. He's a kind man and allows me to work my passage. Tell me, Cornelis, where are we?
This river steamer is pulling the Essen barges. It's how the Germans munition their Balkan campaign. Strings of barges load up at the big factories in Westphalia,
and move through the canals from the Rhine or the Elbe to the Danube.
This is the Danube?
Yes. Once the barges reach Turkey, we'll disappear and make our way to Constantinople.
Whatever you say, Cornelis.
Let's go up on deck for a breath of air. Junger!
Yeah?
Bring me men in mantle.
They have grown a mantle?
Yeah, they grown a mantle. Good Lord. Peter, Grunemantel. I heard Stumm say Unmantel and could make nothing of it. Now I'm sure it was Grunemantel.
Your green goat, Cornelis?
Well, whatever it might be, Grunemantel, Greenmantel, is some talisman for the business in the East and connected in some way with the mysterious von Einem. Peter, my old friend, our quest might not be so hopeless after all.
I don't quite know what I'd expected Constantinople to look like. An eastern city, all white marble, blue water and roses and nightingales. I had forgotten that winter is pretty much the same everywhere. And today was the 17th of January. The Kurdish bazaar was a filthy place. The lanes were long troughs of mud, and the icy wind stirred the garbage. It was almost pitch dark.
Cornelis, do you know that we are being followed? Ever since we came to this evil-smelling place.
Just keep your gun handy, Peter.
We are being followed close, Cornelis.
Where is this damned coffee house? I can see no lights, nothing.
Here they come, Cornelis!
We've got it in the neck this time.
I'm here! A door! A compressor! That's it! Inside, quick!
Good evening, gentlemen. You honor my coffee house with your presence. I am Angelo Cuprasso. How may I be of service?
We wish to visit the garden house of Suleiman the Red.
Ah, you have heard there is to be a performance by La Compagnie des Heures Roses.
What's that, Cornelis?
The Companions of the Rosy Hours.
Please, follow me. The entrance to the garden is at the back.
Lead on, Mr. Cuprasso. We're all for the Rosy Hours.
You are fortunate, gentlemen. The garden house is sometimes open, sometimes not. Last week, we had the ballet of Mamsel Chichi. For the German officers, you understand. But tonight, there will be wonderful dancing. Behold, the garden house of Suleiman the Red. I shall have coffee sent to your table. Enjoy the evening, gentlemen.
That girl dancing, Cornelis. Is she Mademoiselle Chichi?
Some mademoiselle or other.
The lights are going out.
La Compagnie des Heures.
Into a circle of light stepped an eldritch apparition. A tall man dressed in skins, with bare legs and sandal-shod feet. A wisp of scarlet cloth clung to his shoulders, and drawn over his head, down close to his eyes, was a skull cap made of a fox pelt with a tail waving behind it. His eyes were glassy, like a man who smokes hemp. Behind him came six others, also in skins, but with bare heads and long, tangled hair. Suddenly, the leader flung some stuff into a brazier, and a great fan of blue light went up. I became aware that a queer scent had stolen into the atmosphere. Passion. Terrible, savage passion was beating in the air. The dancers became monstrous, inhuman, devilish. The companions of the Rosy Hours were the only thing in the world to fear. I felt the burning eyes of their leader looking for me in the gloom.
These devils are smelling us out, Cornelis. Like Kaffir witch doctors.
Give the Kaffir devils on! So soon!
Everson!
But no need for an arm, ladies and gentlemen.
Turkish police, Peter.
They're looking for us, Cornelis.
Storm has tracked us down. This is the end, old friend.
But we will put up a good fight.
The companions of the Rosy Hours abandoned their dance and began to press around Peter and me, forcing us towards the stage. Their leader urged them on with high-pitched cries. We were trapped by these devils. I made an attempt to break free, and the leader of these dancing maniacs, his eyes blazing, grasped my arm in a vice-like grip. He brought his face close to mine. Under the skullcap, he grinned horribly.
Dick, I'm most awfully glad to see you again.
Sandy! Is that you? You look like a dervish witch doctor.
I am a dervish witch doctor. We should leave now, old chap. In fact, we should run for our lives.
In Greenmantle by John Buchan, dramatized by Patricia Hannah. Richard Hannay was played by David Robb. Sandy Arbuthnot by James Fleet. Sir Walter Bullivant, Clive Merrison. John S. Blenkiron, Stuart Milligan. Peter Pinar, John Glover. Ulrich von Stumm, Jack Claff. German agent, David Timson. German mother, Rachel Atkins. Herr Gaudian, Harry Myers. Undersecretary, Matthew Pigeon. Other parts were played by the cast. The director was Bruce Young.